From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is senior VOA reporter Mohammed El-Shenawy. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Shadi Hamid. He's senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution and co-editor of the new book, Rethinking Political Islam. The book covers 12 countries and features contributions from more than 15 leading experts on Islamist movements across the Middle East, North Africa, and South and East Asia. In this collection of essays, Shadi Hamid and his co-editor William McCants analyze the condition of political Islam in the wake of the twin shocks of the Arab Spring and the rise of the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Shadi Hamid is also the author of Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World, an award-winning book about which we had the pleasure of interviewing him in 2016. He joins us now at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss the new publication, Rethinking Political Islam. Shadi Hamid, welcome to the program.
Hi, Carol. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure and always a pleasure to welcome my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, Shadi Hamid, congratulations to you and Will McCants on this new edition.
Thank you.
What prompted you and him to compile these essays about political Islam at this very time?
So a lot has changed in the last few years. One thing that we try to emphasize is this idea of the twin shocks. So the rise of ISIS or the Islamic State and the Egyptian coup in Egypt in 2013, which overthrew the elected government of the Muslim Brotherhood. These two developments have really forced Islamist movements to rethink some of their assumptions. But I think also as observers and experts who work on these issues, we have to rethink our own assumptions as well and try to take stock of where are we now, what, you know, more than 6 years after the start of the Arab Spring. And also this very stark sense of rise and fall that you have these democratic openings throughout the Middle East. And we've seen a complete reversal to kind of the authoritarian status quo. So that, I think, has also been a bit of a depressing development for anyone who was hoping that things would turn out better. So there's a lot to sort of absorb. And that's what we try to do in this book, covering 12 countries. And also, I think, trying to talk to not just experts on Islamism, but also Islamists themselves. And a very unique part of this book is that we have contributions from members of the Muslim Brotherhood, of Ennahda in Tunisia, the Jordanian Brotherhood. And that might be controversial to some people to actually have Islamist voices responding and offering their own thoughts on their own movements. But we sort of thought, well, if you want to understand Islamist movements, you kind of have to talk to actual Islamists.
And of course, let's remind our listeners that political Islam is not a monolith. I mean, it varies perhaps from country to country, but there must be some kind of common denominator. Is it accurate, Shadi Hamid, to say that political Islam basically consists of political theories that have as their goal the establishment of an Islamic political order, in the sense of a state whose governing principles, institutions, and legal system derive directly from Sharia, the legal code?
Exactly, yeah. So these are groups that want Islam and Islamic law to play a central role in public life. So they want to create Islamic states or Islamic societies and to change the overall political order. Now, the groups that we focus on the most in this book are what we call mainstream Islamist movements. And these are groups that participate in democratic elections. They have representation in parliament. They're gradualist. In other words, they play the long game over decades. They're not trying to overthrow regimes overnight. They're also, importantly, mass movements with hundreds of thousands of members and supporters. And this is in stark contrast to probably the Islamist movement we're most familiar with from the headlines, which is ISIS. ISIS is not a mainstream Islamist movement. It's what we would call an extremist movement, obviously, and they're quite different because they don't believe in parliamentary elections. They don't believe in any authority coming from the people. They believe in imposing, obviously, a very brutal, strict interpretation of Islamic law. So I think it's really important to draw a contrast between different kinds of Islamist groups. So we use this word, but there's quite a lot of diversity within the world of political Islam. And You know, that's why I've always thought it's problematic when people say all Islamists are bad or Islamism is the problem. Some Islamism might be bad, evil, or the problem, but not all Islamists are the same. And making those distinctions, I think, is really important.
Indeed, it's very important that you distinguish between these mainstream political movements and an extremist terrorist organization like the so-called Islamic State. It's just off the rails. Let me now turn to my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawy, for a question.
Let's start with Egypt. In Egypt, the state branded the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a mainstream Islamist group, as a terrorist organization. Would its exclusion from political life push its members to underground violence?
I think a lot of us were worried about this when the coup happened in 2013, in July 2013, and a month later, there was the worst mass killing in modern Egyptian history, which is commonly known as the Rabah Massacre, which happened on August 14th, 2013. So I think a real concern was, after these increasing levels of repression against the Muslim Brotherhood, would that drive Muslim Brotherhood members to violence or terrorism? What we have seen is some low-level violence, not endorsed by the organization writ large, but from individual members of the Brotherhood who sort of go their own way, and they tend to be sort of younger, more quote-unquote revolutionary members of the Brotherhood who actually think that the leadership of the organization has been too nice and gentle and has emphasized peacefulness too much. And they say, well, we want to be able to defend ourselves from the repression of the regime. That's what they would say. And one phrase that I've heard from young Muslim Brotherhood members is this phrase, defensive violence or smart violence. And obviously that's a way for them in their own minds to justify certain kinds of violent behavior. But to be clear, this is not sort of Al-Qaeda-style terrorism. This is more kind of low-level anarchic violence, you know, Molotov cocktails, economic sabotage, so-called revenge attacks against policemen, so things like that. So we have seen some of that, but we have not seen mass violence in Egypt. And I think this is a relief to a lot of us who were worried, how bad is this going to get? And I think that that tells us something about the kind of organization that the Muslim Brotherhood is, that they've been very cautious about not going in this overall violent direction. And that's for a lot of reasons. And one of them is that violence doesn't have a great track record in many of these countries. So I think there's a sense that violence is not very effective. Violence also invites the regime to crack down even more aggressively.
How differently was the experience of Muslim Brotherhood in Tunisia with al-Nahda presenting a new model for Islamism?
So al-Nahda is in some ways the only positive case of Islamist movements participating in government. Maybe we could also talk about Morocco with the Justice and Development Party. Those would be the two more positive cases. Ennahda is a Muslim Brotherhood-inspired movement, even though they've tried to distance themselves from sort of the mother movement of the Egyptian Brotherhood. I think the one thing that they learned, especially watching the coup unfold in Egypt, is they said, we better be careful because we don't want that to happen in Tunisia. And there were actually mass protests on the part of secular and leftist groups that were calling for the downfall of al-Nahda when they were in government in 2013. So a lot of these things were happening at the same time, and al-Nahda was, as a party, was smart enough to say, hey, we better be as careful and cautious as possible and be more inclusive towards other parties and to also make more concessions and compromises. So al-Nahda voluntarily stepped down from power. And that was a controversial thing among some of its own members who said, well, we were democratically elected. Why should we give up power? But the leadership, which was very cautious, led by Rashid Ghannouchi, the kind of historic founder of the movement, again, they were playing this long game, this very cautious approach of saying survival is the number one priority. And I think if we look at a lot of these different cases, we see Islamist movements after sort of the hype and hope of the early Arab Spring period, where they thought that things would go their way and they were riding the wave, we see a reversal and then the focus turns to survival. It's no longer how do you win power and implement your agenda or have more Sharia in the constitution or in the government, those things start to be almost too ambitious. And it goes back to the very basics of how do we get through this very difficult time when regimes are pushing back, when the international community is becoming more hostile towards Islamist movements.
What about Turkey, Shadi Hamid, especially with the authoritarian rule of Recep Tayyip Erdogan? He has the Justice Development Party. He was trying to, I guess, somehow strike a balance between the very secular regimes that preceded him and insert some sort of, you know, political Islam. But by the same token, he has now become so authoritarian that it even tarnishes his version of political Islam for the Justice and Development Party. He has really gone off the rails, many would say.
Yeah, and I think that this has turned out to be a cautionary tale. That, you know, at the start of the Arab Spring, I remember having conversations with people, and people still use the phrase the Turkish model. Yeah. And they saw the Justice and Development Party, the AKP in Turkey, the party of Erdogan, to be a model for other Islamist movements. And Erdogan was traveling in 2011 to Egypt and talking to different Brotherhood affiliates and saying, hey, this is your chance, be smart about it. And this is where there's some irony that he himself succumbed, if you will, to the temptations of power. Now, it's worth noting that Erdogan is still quite popular and has won a succession of elections starting in 2002. So he has been, in some sense, in power and the dominant political figure in Turkey for more than 15 years now. So we're talking about a longer period of time, but we start to see, especially the last few years, Erdogan becoming more obsessed with holding on to power, more paranoid about his enemies. But, you know, it's sometimes difficult to talk about paranoia in the context of the Middle East because leaders are oftentimes overly paranoid, but their paranoia is based at least in part in some reality. So in the case of Turkey, there was an attempted coup against Erdogan in May 2016, and that triggered Erdogan to move in this more authoritarian direction and to see his enemies everywhere in the state, in the media. And the crackdown on the Turkish media has been quite striking. And I think that if we want to understand why Turkey has become so polarized, it does really come back. It's not everything, but it's a key part of it, which is these unresolved questions over the role of religion in public life. And there is a very stark divide between the Islamists of Erdogan's party and secularists. And in Turkey, it's not the sort of soft secularists. These are hardcore secularists who really want to have a full separation of religion and politics, drawing on the legacy of Atatürk, who was the first very aggressive secular modernizer in sort of the modern Middle East, who pushed really aggressively on these things. So they disagree on the fundamentals of what it means to be Turkish, of what the Turkish state should represent. And I think what we have to remember is there are a few things that are more raw and existential than the role of religion. It's really hard to resolve that because how do you split the middle on religion? If you're talking about economic issues, at least you have some numbers that you can deal with. But with religion, there oftentimes is this sense that it's all or nothing. And I think Erdogan wants to use his state power to essentially reshape Turkish society, incentivize piety. And, you know, one phrase that we use is this phrase of soft Islamization. So some Islamist parties aren't necessarily imposing Sharia law, but they are doing things that incentivize people to become more religious. So in the case of Turkey, you give financial incentives for people to get married early, or financial incentives for people to have more than two kids to kind of create the ideal Muslim family, things like that. You have the expansion of Muslim religious schools to reshape the educational system.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Shadi Hamid. He's senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution and co-editor of the new book, Rethinking Political Islam. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is senior VOA reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Now, here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Johannes Alfred from Lafia, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now back to our special guest, Shadi Hamid, co-editor of the new book, Rethinking Political Islam. Well, Shadi, a very quick question, picking up on your conversation about Turkey. Is there room in political Islam for pluralism, for tolerance of others who are not Muslim, even if political Islam dominates in Muslim-majority countries?
So when we talk about tolerance...
And pluralism,
the question is, where do we draw the line? I mean, there are different levels of pluralism, obviously. And I think this is why one thing I've tried to do in my work is to make a distinction between small-d democracy and small-l liberalism. So in other words, you can have parties that are democratically elected, but once they're in power, they pursue illiberal objectives. And illiberal here is referring to the classical liberal tradition of not believing in the classical liberal tradition that is associated with the Western Enlightenment, ideas of freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, gender equality, protection of minority rights, the sort of constitutional protections that we here in America take for granted, or at least did take for granted until pretty recently. So I think that there is a tension there. So you have these Islamist movements coming to power, and they don't believe in Western-style gender equality. They do say problematic things about, say, the Christian minority in Egypt. There are limitations on freedom of religion. So, for example, it'd be very hard to find a member of an Islamist movement who would be okay with the idea of someone leaving Islam and joining another religion and publicly announcing that. Or the question of blasphemy. Should blasphemy be protected under what we would call freedom of expression? So this is where there is a tension. But this is the thing. This is why it's sort of hard to resolve these dilemmas because, you know, at some basic level, we want to believe in small d democracy. But what that requires in practice is respecting democratic outcomes. What happens when we don't like the democratic outcomes? And I'm saying that either as Americans who are observing from the outside or even within these countries. So let's say that you're a secularly oriented Egyptian or Tunisian or Libyan, whatever, and an Islamist party does really well in elections and is about to come to power or comes to power. That's democracy in action in a procedural sense, right? But then you might feel that this Islamist movement in power is threatening your way of life. If you're worried that they might change the nature of the state, or they'll promote religion more aggressively in public life, or as we talked about, reshaping the educational curriculum to be more religiously infused. So this is, I think, where you see some very challenging tensions. And I think Egypt is sort of the most stark and troubling example of this, where you have many Egyptians who claim to believe in democracy, who would describe themselves as pro-democracy or liberal, but they actually end up supporting the military coup against the Muslim Brotherhood. Why? Because they saw the Muslim Brotherhood as being an unacceptable threat, even though they were democratically elected. Too much was at stake. And this is where you have this very dangerous dynamic in many Middle Eastern countries where there's a sense of winner takes all, and that there's not enough room for people to share power together.
A quick comment before I turn to my colleague, Mohammed El-Shanawi. Let's be equal opportunity critics here. There are many monarchies, let's say in Saudi Arabia and other Arab states, who are equally, one could say, either intolerant or do not condone pluralism. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, one cannot freely worship as a Christian in public. So there's a lot of limitations in these states as well, who are often very critical of the Muslim Brotherhood or other political Islamist movements.
That's a really good point, because sometimes we look at a country like Saudi Arabia, which is at least to some degree a theocracy in the sense that the religious establishment plays a very important role in government and education and so on. But even though Saudi Arabia has a strict implementation of Islamic law, Saudi Arabia has a pronounced dislike for the Muslim Brotherhood, which might sound counterintuitive to some people. But just because you believe that Islam has a role to play in public life, it doesn't mean that you're going to agree with other groups that believe that Islam has a role to play in public life. And the same could be said for ISIS. ISIS considers the Muslim Brotherhood to be apostates, that they're soft, that they've betrayed the Islamic ideal, and they believe in parliaments and democratic elections. And for ISIS, that is a red line. And then we can kind of take that even further and say, when you have a Shia Islamist government, as you have in Iran, Shia Islamist governments do not get along with, say, Saudi Arabia, even though they're both technically Islamist in some sense. So there's a lot going on there. And I think that this is also part of the regional context where you have countries like Saudi Arabia that really tried to push back when the Muslim Brotherhood and its various affiliates were doing well in the early Arab Spring. Saudi Arabia saw that as a real threat. But some of that had to do with plain domestic considerations. If you are a more autocratically oriented state and you're afraid about your hold on power, you don't want to see Islamist parties doing well in elections and unseating long-standing regimes. And that's why they saw the downfall of Hosni Mubarak, who wasn't an Islamist. He was quote-unquote secular. It's not quite that, but still, Saudi Arabia was very disappointed when Hosni Mubarak was overthrown in the Egyptian uprising in 2011.
Well, certainly, because they share authoritarian tendencies.
So how would you describe, Shadi, the state of Libyan Islamists, especially with Egypt backing Libyan National Army leader Khalifa Haftar against Libyan Islamists?
So Libya is a fascinating case that doesn't get nearly as much attention as it deserves, in part because it's a mess and it's complicated. But I think that you sort of have this strongman dynamic. So you mentioned General Khalifa Haftar, who is sort of modeling himself as the sort of Libyan version of Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, someone who is very staunchly anti-Islamist and lumps all Islamists together basically in the same category. So for General Haftar and his military operations, he doesn't make a distinction between fighting ISIS or fighting groups that are maybe closer to the Muslim Brotherhood's, the Libyan Muslim Brotherhood's ideology. And that's one reason that he's received support and backing from not just the Egyptian government, but also the UAE and Saudi Arabia and others. So, and this kind of gets to, I think, one of the very challenging aspects of this new Middle East is that nothing is just local anymore. To understand Libyan Islamists, we can't just look at Libya. We have to look at the regional dynamic where everyone has a proxy that they want to back. So Qatar, on the other hand, is supporting certain Islamist movements that are against General Haftar. So everyone is trying to find their sort of local militias to support. And that sort of, I think, undermines the agency of the Libyan people. The Libyan people obviously have more choice today than they did under the Gaddafi regime, but there are a lot of regional dynamics that are making it harder for Libya to recover.
Shadi Hamid, how do you see political Islamist movements staying relevant, evolving, given the challenges? On the one hand, authoritarian regimes, Saudi Arabia now in Egypt, having overthrown the democratically elected, even if authoritarian, Muslim Brotherhood Morsi regime. Can you point to some evolutionary trends?
In interviewing members of Islamist movements, and that's one thing I've tried to do in my own work, is, you know, we don't have to like members of the Brotherhood, but we have to understand them by talking to them. And you do have quite a bit of rethinking, but in a lot of different ways. So one thing you hear is from some of the younger, more revolutionary members of the movement is that the Brotherhood wasn't as revolutionary as they should have been in 2011. So Mubarak falls, but then the military manages the democratic transition in a very problematic way. And the Brotherhood comes to terms with that and works with the military and tries to reach an accommodation with the military. Did they seek power too quickly? And this is one thing you also hear is, should they have contested the Egyptian presidency so soon after the 2011 uprising. In retrospect, perhaps not. It didn't turn out so well. I think one other interesting thing, and if in a number of the chapters in the book, the various contributors look at this, is the relationship between the religious movement and the political party. So if you look at each of these movements, whether it's the PJD in Morocco or the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, they are in some basic sense religious movements, but they're also at the same time political parties. And that can lead to some confusion because the job of a religious movement is to spread your influence throughout society. It's to focus on religious education and preaching and establishing a network of schools, hospitals, clinics, and businesses. What's the job of a political party, though? The political parties focus on elections and ideally trying to win them. So the goals of a party and a movement can be quite different. And I think one aspect of rethinking that you hear from more open-minded members of these movements is, how do you find a way to establish some degree of separation between the movement and the party? Because the danger is, if the party and the movement are too closely intertwined, if the party comes to power and alienates a lot of people with controversial policies, do you want Egyptians or Tunisians to blame the religious movement for the political failures? And that could even lead to almost seeing religion as a problem. And I think that there's more of a realization now that there has to be some way to insulate the religious movement from kind of the everyday give and take and the messy compromises of politics.
With rethinking political Islam, would the U.S. policy toward political Islam witness a huge difference between what Obama administration did and what could the Trump administration do with the political Islam?
You know, in some ways, the debate that we're having in Washington over political Islam, I feel like we've gone backwards a lot. And in some ways, I think we're back to where we started in the early 1990s. And that's when issues around Islamism started to become a bigger issue for U.S. policymakers, because something very important happened in 1992. That was the first time an Islamist party was on the verge of coming to power through democratic elections. The staunchly secular Algerian military stepped in and aborted the elections. So the U.S. and France and other Western nations had to sort of devise a response to this. They didn't trust this Islamist party. But at the same time, the Algerian military very clearly violated the democratic process. So this is where you have this so-called Islamist dilemma for the first time. And I think in some ways, you know, the Trump administration has shifted away from the Obama administration's approach and has taken a harder line against all Islamist movements. And there was a discussion earlier this year about whether or not the Muslim Brotherhood should be designated as a terrorist organization. So that would be by the U.S. State Department. That has not happened, but that would have been a very radical shift if there was even a movement in that direction. The U.S. has never designated the Brotherhood as a terrorist organization before, so that would have been obviously very controversial. So I think we're back to having some very basic discussions about who are Islamists? Are they all bad? How to make very basic distinctions between different kinds of Islamist groups. And I think from my perspective, that's unfortunate, because I would have liked to have thought that over the past 25 years since the Algerian coup in 1992, that there would have been some progress around having a better understanding of these movements and not lumping them together in the same broad basket.
And Shadi Hamid, I think when we see this alignment between the Trump administration and the monarchy in Saudi Arabia, it's just an affirmation or a reinforcement of this particular trend.
That's one thing that they share, you know, as different as obviously President Trump and the Saudi leadership are. They do share this fear and distrust of anything relating to the Muslim Brotherhood. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't engage with them in the effort to understand what these movements are saying or doing on the ground. The basic idea is that these are mass movements. They have at least some level of broad popular support in many Middle Eastern countries. And from a national security perspective, the U.S. has to understand broad-based movements in countries of strategic concern, regardless of how we feel about the specific content of their ideology.
The book is Rethinking Political Islam. The co-editor, Shadi Hamid, he's senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations at the Brookings Institution. Shadi, thanks again for coming in. Congratulations on your book.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And joining me on the program was senior VOA reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.